Did you hear about the JavaScript programmer that couldn't move up in work? Yeah, that's right. He didn't get a raise. Hey, howdy, howdy, ho. It's Daniel Markham with Nerd Roundup. If you haven't been to Nerd Roundup before, really, you haven't missed out on a lot in life. Maybe some, I don't know, but probably not that much. Nerd Roundup is something where we get together once a week, talk about the news of the week. And I have an open forum with about a dozen of my friends. They're free to drop by. We're not trying to do a lot of tech stuff. I tell people there's a lot of tech content, but I'm hoping there's nothing of any value here. We're not trying to concentrate a million technical things into one conversation. Instead, what we like to do is demonstrate the values we like people to apply in their own teams. And in your own team, you should be able to kick back and talk about dang near anything and have a good time doing that. So grab your lunch, pull up to the bar, and join us for Nerd Round. This week we have James Grinning and Greg Young. Hey, guys.
Good morning, Daniel.
Morning. James, what have you been up to this week?
I've been helping 14 embedded systems engineers in Norway learn test-driven development.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So TDD is completely different in an embedded system.
Well, you know, in a way, all the problems are the same. A dependency on hardware is like a dependency on a database.
Yep.
It causes a problem.
You're pitching softballs to them. So you're pitching softballs to James. James has got a class, if you get a chance to take it. It is way, way cool. He shows how to set up a framework around testing embedded stuff. I like it a lot.
And then this morning, I've got a friend and a colleague in Germany who did the follow-up workshop, so they get into their code then, and he gets to help them discover how to get their code that depends way too much on the hardware to be testable, right? And so there's a lot of interesting techniques. One of the steps in the process is don't panic.
And do you wave a towel at any point?
At any time, just don't panic. We'll figure something out.
It's weird because
that's what I've been doing.
If you've done a lot of this before, you know that you can get there. It's just sort of reassuring folks, okay, other people have done this.
Yeah. Yeah, and pretty much universally, every time that we do one of these workshops, you know, when you finally get into their code, everybody wants to give up after 15 minutes. And it's like, no, we'll never get there. And then you just, through the diligent solving one problem at a time, you get there. And then people go, well, that wasn't so bad. It would be nice if it was. But it's usually all their fault that it takes a long time to do it, because it's problems with their code, you know, dependencies and such. So
just as a question for you.
Yeah.
I've worked in this quite a bit.
Yeah.
How are you doing the segregation of test runs? Are you doing it so when I'm working on my laptop, I'm running on, say, an emulator, and then when I check in, the CI server is actually running on real hardware?
Uh-huh.
Or are you trying to do real hardware all the way out to the developer?
Actually, what I'm trying to do is get people to stop running on the real hardware, except in a CI or in a lab environment. So I'd encourage people to get into a TDD environment off target. You know, you are programming in C or C++, which are supposedly portable. And if you work at it, they can be portable.
Yes.
And so it's about a separation of concerns. And, you know, so one stage of the activity, I kind of describe it as there's five different stages in the TDD cycle for embedded. The first one would be test what you can off the hardware. You know, so you have to manage dependencies and provide stubs for hardware and such like that. The second stage is do your production build and make sure you didn't break anything, because you're using a different compiler for off target than you are for target.
Yep.
And so then that would be done by the CI system. Then the third stage would be, if you're willing to invest in this, also run your target, run your unit tests compiled for the target. You know, so if you're using, somebody's special tool chain, now you got to build all your tests for that tool chain, and you got to have an embedded platform, at least processor-wise, usually an eval board or something like that, where it's got enough memory to hold unit tests and your product, because lots of times, you know, embedded system will hold its production code only and nothing else. But now there's, you know, memory's cheaper, but so you could buy a board to run unit tests in, and then you've got the target, in which case you might write So the fourth stage would be having tests that run in the target, and they might interact with the target at that point. Those might be integration tests. And then finally, you do whatever you had to do to make sure your product works.
It's interesting because by using a lower level language, C++ or C, you're able to do that sort of tiered stubbing where you stub the whole thing, stub a little less and less. Yeah. I think it'd be much more difficult if you're using a higher level language. It would be kind of tough.
Well, it's the same problem. And it's, you know, kind of dependent on what's the fan out, you know, how much of a dependency octopus do you have, right? You know, so if there's a lot of dependencies, then that causes a lot more problems. You know, and so that little pressure from test-driven development to, you know, try to isolate things more and manage dependencies kind of leaves you with, you know, a system that, you know, people have been talking about coupling and cohesion forever, right?
Yeah.
And then you don't really know how you're doing until you try to test the piece.
But you're... Okay, everybody froze for a second. Come back, folks. Hello, where you at, guys? Oh, wow. We got, well, we got the timeline's advancing. Yeah, see. Here I am by myself. Talking
many, many years ago. How much time we could have actually taken out of our pipeline if we had automated that and actually had unit tests that ran on that machine.
Yep.
It's almost sad when you think about the amount of manpower and money we're just throwing away. Greg,
on my website, I have people answer a questionnaire before a training class about, you know, what do they currently do? And pretty much universally, now you're starting to see some people are doing some unit testing, but if you go look at the history of all the answers to these questions, people are testing on target only and doing things like, you know, log messages and single stepping with debuggers to find out if their code works.
Wait. Single stepping with debuggers? These guys aren't embedded systems engineers.
Well, single, you know, with a JTAG emulator probe, right? Okay, you know, so in the turnaround cycle is often measured in minutes, tens of minutes, or hours.
Jeez.
In which case, you can't do test-driven. And you're wasting a lot of time between, you know, when you're on the hunt for a problem,
yeah.
And if you've got to wait 10 minutes between tries, it takes your mind out of the problem. And, you know, you wasted the 10 minutes waiting, and your mind, you got distracted because you went and did something else. So you're not in the zone anymore.
Right. So one I used to work on was a video overlay system for horse racing. Basically, it took the data that was coming out of the horse racing system and did video overlays that could then be put on top of the video of the horses running around.
Oh, cool. Kind of like they do in a football game with here's the...
Right. And we're talking, this is 2000.
Yeah, cool.
It was called the VGS, the video graphics system.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem with trying to do TDD on that thing was that to build, move it over, burn EEPROMs, get the EEPROMs into the machine was probably a 15 to 30 minute process.
Yeah.
Yep.
So,
including the erasing of the EEPROMs, because you had an extra set, probably, right?
Right. That is a very easy optimization to come to.
Yeah.
But doing TDD in that type of environment was, even today, I would say, extraordinarily difficult.
Yeah.
Well, you don't do TDD in that environment.
No, that's the thing, right?
You separate your code from its dependencies, and you do TDD on the bulk of your code,
yes,
independent of the hardware, and then you periodically, hopefully pretty regularly, deploy. And maybe you can have that done through a CI sort of thing like you were mentioning, right? So when you check in, it goes through that build chain and downloads it and runs.
Right, and I can see that.
You become asynchronous.
I can see that for, let's say, the communications code that was occurring.
Yeah.
Where I don't see that working was the vast majority of the code in that system.
That's a different embedded system. You're talking probably about two systems, or two or three systems, actually, right?
Well, Greg, I got to tell you something though. Everybody thinks they're special.
Yeah, everybody's special, my friend.
Greg, I don't want to be the first to break it to you. But you're special, but it doesn't matter.
So
I haven't worked in that environment, so I don't know. But
the problem is the vast majority of the logic there is in taking the data that's coming up that feed, and converting it into something that's on the television.
Okay.
So it's all graphics work.
Yeah.
Which is relatively hard to do TDD.
See, the thing is James is working with people who do driver level code, who do radio code, do this real kind of data work coming through, same kind of stuff.
The bulk of your code probably will be test drivable, and maybe the special thing you're thinking of won't be, but a lot will be, right?
Don't get me wrong. I can look at like the terminals that we were building. And the terminals would absolutely be relatively easily made into a TDD environment. But for something like the graphics device, I just don't see how it would really work. And you run into the same problems with if I'm building out a video game trying to TDD the graphics of the video game.
So I'm going to do it. I'm going to do like, guys, we can take the whole hour and talk about graphics cards and TDD. And I would love to do that. Give me about 15 seconds. Yep. I'll tell you what I did. I'll bring the first article up, and if you want to go back to graphics cards, that's cool too. But just let me kind of transition over.
We can talk some more. Maybe we'll find another excuse.
It's a great call because the thing is, it's real time processing of data. What I've been doing this week.
Daniel, back to the regular show.
Back to our sponsor. I wrote this essay, "Your Product Isn't My Service," because people get products and services mixed up all the time in XP. Had a conversation with Michael Feathers for a while, which was kind of fun. If you get a chance to read the essay, I got some nice graphics in there. What else? Here's our stories for this week. So I got the first link up. This is the rise of user hostile software. And this guy basically makes the point, and I agree with him, that your software, you know, we keep telling people to build stuff people want. But in fact, if you look at real software, it doesn't like you. It's looking to manipulate you. It's looking like games are trying to get you to do microtransactions. It's as if they actively, your software is not there for you. Your software is there for the people making the software and the platforms.
These damn people. They ruin everything.
Yeah, I've been playing this Royal Match game on my phone that my wife told me I had to install. And I lost about 12 hours the first day. And I didn't spend any money, but I could tell the game's whole design was just to try to get me to spend money. That was the purpose of the game.
Yeah, you know, I just fell and touched the thing, okay, I'll play Wudoku, right? It's like, prove you're a genius, play Wudoku, which is like a building blocks thing. It's like, you know, it's like, it looks intriguing, and I have a little bit of time to kill.
Yeah.
But they made it almost impossible to exit the app.
Oh, my God.
I had to look up online how to get out of the app. It sucked down battery like crazy, and every time a game was over, I pretty much rigged the game so you couldn't win, I'm sure. Every time the game was over, you had to live through a 10-second ad. I unloaded it and gave it a 0-star rating.
Well, these guys, what they've done, this is like a Bejeweled game where you just you drag the screen and make little matches of three. It's all free. You get 5 free lives. And surprise, surprise, your first 5 lives, you go really far and you make these little matches and it makes little cool sound effects and your dopamine system's just hitting. And then as you get to the end of your free lives, you get down to where like you only have one match left to win. And you lose your last life. Oh, if you have $1.99, you can go another 5 lives. And it does that every time. It gives you these real wonderful runs where you're making all this progress and you think you're a genius. And then at the very end, it's like, oh, wow, if you only had a couple more turns, you could do it. And I told my wife, I'm like, you know, Melissa, nobody's guaranteeing that these are random things falling from the ceiling that you're matching in this game. In fact, I would be willing to bet $100 it's not. So, you know, this is not stuff free. This is gambling. This is Vegas, right?
Yeah, that was the. I read some of the other reviews of the game that I was playing, And people have pretty much concluded that, you know, this is not random.
No.
They're giving you unwinnable situations on purpose.
I try not to tell my wife about this because it's depressing. You know, this goes back to the first mechanical pinball games. When more than one player would play, it would pop. You would hit the last two digits almost about half the time because the game designers realized that if you had three or four people playing and they gave one guy a free game, well, guess what? The other three people are going to be playing the next game too. And that was, I guess, had been 50 years ago. Speaking of people who hate you, Lenovo has decided to force an upgrade on some tablet owners, and the forced upgrade makes them look at ads on their tablet now, whether they want to or not. It just blows my mind. It's like Darth Vader stuff.
That's just horrible.
Why are you in this business if what you're creating? I'd rather be building, you know, software for bombs. At least I'm honest about what I'm doing to people.
Well, Lenovo, I've been running their machines for many years. And the reason I ran them was because they always made quality machines. They were decent. I actually got a new Lenovo laptop not too long ago. Holy crap, was there a lot of stuff on it. The first thing I did when I got it was wipe it.
Lenovo's a Chinese company, right?
Lenovo?
They bought IBM.
Samsung's Korean. I can't keep track.
I think it's a Chinese company. I think they bought IBM, the ThinkPad line, years ago.
Lenovo is founded in Beijing.
Yeah.
It was originally Legend.
Okay. Yeah, they bought out the ThinkPad stuff. I remember when Lenovo took over the ThinkPad, everybody was like, oh, God, it's going to go to crap now. And it was okay for like a model or two, but then it went to crap.
Well, I'm on an X1 right now. They have not completely trashed the X1 series, although it's this iteration that they started becoming somewhat decent again. There's like one or two iterations where they got kind of weird, and then they kind of came back.
I'm guessing
because they got a lot of pushback of people like me going, I don't want all this crap.
Yeah. And you're like with cell phones, you're forced to either take over the whole OS, and then sometimes they won't give you service anymore or upgrades. Or put up with whatever they decide to shove down the path at you.
Well,
yeah.
Just as a weird little side note, so an X1 is a very good laptop to look at, especially if you happen to be running Unix, FreeBSD, one of these, because so many developers, like core developers, are actually running them.
Ooh, cool.
So you're basically guaranteed an out-of-the-box experience that'll just work.
I've been really happy with my HP Spectre 360. They sort of did a map to the Mac then Air. They did a Mac Air, but they did a Mac Air for the Windows operating system. They did a really good job with it. Speaking of really cool machines, I had this coming up. I moved it up closer. The System 76 has a new notebook out. And if you're not familiar with System 76, they are currently the Alienware guys. They're the guys you go to if you want a notebook that like can fly to the moon. You can like kill Superman with one of these notebooks. It's got the new Ryzen CPU from AMD. It's got Radeon graphics. It's got up to 64 gigabytes of memory. I just love saying that. It's like, wow.
I was looking at a Dell the other day, I believe. That was upgradable to either 128 or 256. I think it's 256. Who the hell needs 256 gigs of memory in their laptop?
Thanks, Bill Gates. Yeah, who would ever need 256?
Who's to say need it or not?
Well, if you don't give it to them, they'll never need it, I guess.
Well, but I'm wondering what the use case for this might be.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've got, I think, 8 or 16 on this Asus ROG, and I was trying to do some, just like downloading the web pages on a notebook. It couldn't happen. Put it on this thing, and I watched the memory just go, and it worked here. But basically, the problem was that the app I was using was just eating all the memory, and the whole thing crashed. So Yeah, I could see.
Well, my guess for the use case was they want to be able to run 40 tabs in Chrome.
40 tabs in Chrome. There's also a lot of people do virtual machine stuff with a lot of memory.
It might be an ultimate gamer machine, too.
Gamer machine. You don't want to be hitting like that slow SSD drive. You want to get everything, RAM, or even better, that L2, L1 cache would be ideal.
So what I've been waiting to see, which we've kind of seen pieces of it that have come up, but we haven't seen it truly done, is when we get to the point where we have browser windows that are actually virtual machines. And I don't mean that I'm connected over the network and getting the output of my virtual machine. I mean it is the virtual machine.
Yeah, that's where Chromebook and Wasm are headed. That all that stuff is we're exactly where we're going with all that stuff. And then James will have people who are building drivers on hardware where the hardware is running the drivers in the software that's running. It's going to be 4 or 5 levels before you finally get to the guy actually using the dang thing.
Yeah, oh, so, dear, I believe there's a movie about this.
Inception.
Cyber Dojo, which is the thing I use to facilitate training, every time somebody pushes the test button, it's run in a Docker container, a new Docker container. And they deploy these. Maybe it's not a new one. Could be, though. But at any rate, every time they push it, the first version of Cyber Dojo had RM. It was possible to go into the shell script that for your run and type rm-r/ and wipe out the whole system.
Whoopsie.
Then John got really smart about Docker containers. He's made an amazing flexible system. Anyway.
I love a container.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute here. You could do rm-r. I don't think so. You probably need to do rm-rf.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, for him. You got to have the force flex.
What's... RF? Okay. Might have been RF. Yeah.
And you might have your pseudo
without
as well.
The force flag, you probably got back a whole bunch of errors of like, I can't delete this. And
yeah, okay.
I'm a big container fan. Having said that, I'm also a member of the Kubernetes forum on Reddit, and every day I can't get one container to talk to the other. I can't get my pods to talk to one another. I can't set this up, can't set that up. It's painful watching these folks flail around trying to build over-engineered stuff they don't need, pretty much.
So we're going to have to talk in the future, because I've been wanting to build out in my new apartment a Kubernetes-style rack that I have locally where I can just deploy things. And
yeah. Me too, yeah. And it's you can do that with YAML and CloudFormation off of AWS. It's kind of a good place to start. But you can also run up a really big bill and not be aware of what you're spending.
You're going to have a cloud in your apartment.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what I want, yeah.
You'd be like Pigpen or get a fog machine. The next story I thought was very well done. It's a long story. It's by Ann Applebaum on The Atlantic. Somebody said, you ever go to The Atlantic and they never have a story like, I went to the store, I was happy. Everything you read is like, I went to the store. 200 years ago, an Indian walked by this store. And then this is like, then you go through 40,000 words and it... And I was happy. this is quite a long article, but she goes through a lot of stuff about kind of what's wrong with the mob justice cancel culture we have. And it made me happy to see, I kind of see people figuring this thing out slowly. It's like, guys, we weren't just yelling about nothing. There's really something here.
Well, and what's really important about this is that it's being published on The Atlantic.
Yes.
I mean, if this were published on the Wall Street Journal opinion pages, it would not have nearly the same weight. It's where the story comes from that's important.
I am watching, and to their credit, I'm watching some large media companies and very popular. Nate Silver, for instance, did 538 for a while. He's trying to stay sane using statistics and looking at the COVID virus. And he's just getting trashed online by people who were reacting emotionally to what the stats are saying. So I'm starting to see people who would be considered on the left who are like, you know, guys, why are we using the mob to like judge good or bad ideas? It's a dumb thing to do. So I'm happy that more people are talking about this. Like maybe another 5 years they'll figure it out.
Yep. Hopefully.
Yeah, like I said in the notes for this, I hate to bang on this over and over again, but there's a conflict of interest here where the social media companies really want people to be bouncing off the walls emotionally because it drives up shares and likes, and you know these rants are they feed on that. This cool tweet here, I can read it. It's 1989. General Boris Gromov is the last Russian soldier to leave Afghanistan. 1842, Dr. William Brighting, last British person. And yesterday it was the turn of U.S. Army Major General Chris Donahue. And he has pictures of all three. I know this is, and like I said, this has made me more emotional than I think anything has in quite a while. But it is also interesting to see the enormous amount of data that people are sharing on the internet about this, which I think is kind of cool. There were a big argument yesterday over whether the Pentagon left their dogs, the service dogs in Afghanistan.
Yes, I read about this, and there was a huge uproar about how it had been done, and it turned out to be mostly false.
Yes. As it turns out, Afghanistan has its own dogs that seem to kind of get around fine without us. Yeah. I went to Reddit yesterday. I was looking at the Ask Historians forum. I love Ask Historians. Great bunch. But at the top, they had this little notice. We're a member of the whatever, whatever. And I said, well, I wonder what these guys are putting a nose up for, because they're really apolitical. Read the notice, and they were petitioning Reddit to eliminate any COVID disinformation. And one of the first three or four items they had, they were wrong. So it was like, whoa, so, okay.
Mm. Well, I just recently heard an interesting little quote. I forget who said it, but when you mix politics with science, what do you get?
Garbage. Politics. Yeah, garbage. The scientist should be the natural opposite of the politician. And if it's not, then you've got, because the scientist should not care. It doesn't matter. 1 + 1 = 2, no matter whether who's in charge or any argument.
Yeah, unfortunately, our world, the stuff that's going on, it's so complicated, and nobody really has good, compelling, you know, and then the trust has been so diluted or wasted or removed that you can't believe anything.
No, you can't.
And Daniel, I'm going to disagree with your statement there that 1 + 1 = 2. I say 1 + 1 = 10.
You know, if you wrote your own integer class, you could override the operator plus to make it that way.
I represent numbers in binary.
Yeah, obviously, yeah.
Well, we have to get real. We can't. I don't know. You're your own cardinal. You could have your religion. You're the number religion. You could be your own cardinal number.
Yeah, there's a key question there. What base are you talking about, Greg?
Yeah, yeah 1 + 1 = 10. And some
1 + 1 = 11.
11, yes.
Okay, see, that proves it. 1 + 1 = 100. Oh, wait a second, something's not right here.
Yeah, I'm counted wrong in binary. I failed my clan yet again. So this next one I saw on Hacker News, this is a bit of a lark. This guy said, hey, if you're interested in free graphics, I have this site, you can go look at it. And sure enough, really cool graphics. And I kind of laughed to myself because good luck finding free commercial graphics online. You search for like pony, block, you know, key, something, you know, dog, and all the top sites have been SEO gamed, and you end up, you can have this with a watermark, or you can pay us a dollar for 15 free ones. And
yes and no. So the bigger problem is that with all the other images that are out there, I don't necessarily have a clear license to use them.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It's the ones where I have a clear license that allows me usage that we...
Yeah. He stopped talking, but I'm sure he's still talking somewhere. Yep, come back, guys.
Come back.
There you are. We should have had commercials in these little... So the weather's looking good downtown this week.
I could feasibly end up being sued for using it or having someone make a claim against me. So what ends up happening is then there's the sites that are actually built for this, and they do provide that license.
Yeah, I tried to use photographer's work. I tried my best, knock on wood, to abide by these terms. Having said that, I also decided on my blog not to put any sort of commercial activity at all because I didn't want any conflicts going down the road. It's all education. Every now and then I'll link out to my book, but 99% of my links are out to like Wikipedia or whatever.
At the end of the day, you're not a big enough target for anyone to find worthwhile to come after.
It is a cesspool. You know, they've got these bots that go by and identify anything they can and then send you, like, we're going to sue you letter. Next up is...
Only cheat behind a paywall, then.
Yeah, I don't know. Yes, exactly. Make people pay a penny a month or whatever. Why Erlang?
There are actually, if you go look online, some sites which are deliberately.
And the traffic downtown's looking bad, Joe. No, they'll come back in a minute.
Perms I put into Google, but it was something along the lines of public domain images.
Yeah, so Wiki Commons often has public domain in there.
Yes,
we found a bunch there.
Pinterest has keyword bombed a lot of things. Where you look for something, you'll find it on Pinterest. And then you go to Pinterest and they expect you to have an account and log in and all that. And it's like, why are you in my search feed if you're going to?
I have to be honest. Very often when I want a very specific image for something, I will actually contact somebody that I know in that area and I will pay them to go get me that image.
Yes.
And the reason I do this is not because of copyright issues or anything like that. It's very often I want an image of like something in Turkey. And at the same time, I'm helping people in Turkey by doing so. Does that kind of make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's cool stuff. I've played around with Fiverr before. It was fun times. Next article is why Erlang, and this I thought this was not nicely well written, like, hey, here's why I like pizza kind of thing. I also thought it was interesting in that I've coded, two dozen languages, been around for a little bit, a couple of days. It seems like we always end up back either in Lisp or Erlang. I was talking to, like I said, Michael Feathers a couple of days ago, and we were talking about static type versus dynamically typed systems. Erlang is dynamically typed, C, statically typed. And it's like it's either Lisp, Assembly C, or like Erlang. And then everything else is in between somewhere.
There's actually a statically typed overlay on Erlang, if I remember correctly.
You know, Elixir is on top, but they just did that to, like, take Ruby.
No. Elixir is just a different syntax. Yeah. There's also a statically typed thing that you can put on top of Erlang. I forget the name of it, though.
I think I've made the decision my next language is going to be Erlang. It was going to be Haskell for a while, and I just kept procrastinating. But now I think, you know, Erlang is weird enough. It's been around 35 years. The stories I hear about people using it are usually like they replace 80 servers with one. It's worth diving into.
Erlang's a lot of fun, but what you're really going to love about Erlang is the Erlang community.
Oh, cool.
It's much different than other communities. The people that you tend to run into tend to be far, far better than what you would run into in, say, like a Java or C# community.
Well, I think the thing is, too, from a nerdy standpoint, you know, I think I get where Haskell's going. I've done enough F#. I understand type classes because we have to code around them so much in F#. I understand using types to control flow instead of I think I understand the gist of where Haskell's going. Whereas at Erlang, we've got the actor model. We've got the whole idea the system's built for little pieces of it to fail. That's some cool new stuff.
You have to be careful with Erlangers and calling it the actor model. They'll tell you it's not really the actor model.
Oh, my God. What is it?
It just looks and smells much like the actor model.
What do they call it? The messaging, asynchronous messaging. He's reaching for a book. When we're talking to Bob, he usually pulls out like a model of the Enterprise. I don't know. I have no idea what Greg's going to pull out. His own fun with Erlang. Erlang and I at the pond. What is it? What do we got here? Nope, nothing.
Erlang?
Sorry, my microphone muted. I was not pulling out a book.
Ah. Okay, well, that was...
It'd be very odd if I was, because I was pulling something out of the refrigerator.
I don't know if I would go
books
so far.
Books are hot, you know, you got to keep them cool.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Where else would you keep your book? So this next story is a bit beyond my knowledge, but it has to do with artificial intelligence, and it has some really, really cool graphics. It's a very long paper, and if you're interested in this stuff, basically... And I'm going to wing it here. Instead of doing this sort of Markov chain where we're doing matrices, probability linking to other matrices, this idea is using a Gaussian belief system. And it's got a real cool graphic that I snagged to put on the top of the nerd ramp this week. I understand this is how one concept is related to another on a percentage basis, almost like a fuzziness. So I don't know. They're advocating doing this.
What's really been interesting for me is that 20 years ago, I used to work in artificial intelligence quite a bit.
Ooh.
And 20 years ago, you could get into things with a year or two of research and have a relatively good grasp on what was going on inside of artificial intelligence. Today... You cannot keep up with it as fast as it's coming out.
Yeah. I remember looking at the generative adversarial networks when they first became big 5-8 years ago, thinking, oh, wow, I want to dive into this. And I looked at them like, holy crap, I don't have time. This is a whole other world. It's a really cool world, but it's not programming in the way that we understand programming.
Well, I remember the
argument.
You mean
like cause and effect or... I think about programming as cause and effect. You know, can I make this thing happen? And because there's... So why do you say it's not like programming we...
To me, the way I understand this is much more like a sort of a chemical reaction where you throw all kinds of stuff in there and then the system goes through and links things together in little chains and then you process those chains in various ways. You have various ways of creating those chains and measuring that. This Gaussian thing is like, here's a different way of creating chains of stuff. But the whole way you create the chains and the way you make one thing's linked to another and the second layer, how those things organize themselves into groups, there's a neural propagation, there's back propagation, there's a whole ton of stuff that's not cause and effect. It is much more growing. You create an environment that the code grows in.
I'm trying to remember who the paper was by, but it's one of the most seminal papers in artificial intelligence, and it was dealing with neural networks, and whether we are going through backpropagation or whether we are going through what's commonly known as an island model, an evolutionary model, where the main goal was to remove links.
It builds the complexity builds on itself. Like the generative adversarial network says you build two different models. And they have the models fight one another so they can evolve with the best result. Yeah, that's really what you're doing. So there's just layers and layers upon non-cause-effect type things, James.
Well, but what was really cool about this paper, and I'll see if I can find it. Basically, the entire goal of what they were working on was to identify links that are not used and therefore can be removed from the network.
James and I were talking a few weeks ago. There was an article about kids in the womb before they're born, and they measure their brain waves, and there are waves of activity in neural networks that occur that you can actually institute as part of the network before you put the data in. So the kids actually learn to do a lot before they're born because of these recurring waves. It's fascinating. One of the most interesting things about this is we modeled neurons to get into this thing a long time ago. Of course, the Google guys came in from the other side with links. But we think of this in terms of neurons or a brain, but you talk to the brain people, like, oh, hell no, you guys are nothing like brains. Like, geez, we got a chemical super in. A neuron can have, like, you know, 400,000, you know, 40 million connections. So it's almost like an arbitrary bunch of constructs we throw together that do interesting stuff.
Yeah, not modeled after the world.
Well, what you're actually building there is a series of logic gates.
A big series. Oh yeah, like a ocean of logic gates. Sure.
But each neuron in many neural networks is essentially a logic gate. I mean, I've got a sigma of my inputs. If it's greater than my threshold, then I output.
Did you see the? There was a big kerfuffle about memzisters, maybe 8 or 10 years ago. It was the thing the transistor wasn't, that we was predicted we could make a memzister, and it was actually going to model neurons better than transistors do. I haven't followed up on that in a good while.
This has actually been in the news recently.
Cool.
Maybe a month or two ago. Let me see here. And here we go. I just pulled it up, and I got two articles from Nature magazine. Molecular memresistors offer a path to ultra-efficient computing.
Bada boom, bada bing. You too, friends, can come up with buzzwords that appear in the news. Just follow along with their roundup.
I dropped the link in the chat for you.
Ah, cool. See if I can bring it up here. This, I'll bring it down here. There we go. Ah, cool. Hey, that actually worked, kind of.
You don't get to read the article, but.
No, I can't, I'm not going to read. Oh yeah. Oh, speaking of paywalls, subscribe to Journal for only $199 a year. Like, oh yeah, fine. My friend wants me to read about memzisters, and that's obviously worth $200 right there, huh?
Definitely. Might be worth more.
Well, you know, the big data AI guys are making a killing. I mean, there's a non-trivial amount of money there, and it's weird to me, and maybe I'm getting old and cynical, but it's like we nerds keep coming up with this obscure things that nobody can keep track of without spending their entire time doing it. And then we charge a lot of money for it. It's like, hey, we convince people that it's going to generate a lot of income, and then we charge a lot of money, and then we move on to the next thing.
Seems like a good business plan.
It does yeah. seem, I think I've actually rode that wave for a while. Okay, next up is radically new hydrogen fuel cell technology to transform aviation. If this is true, this would be really cool. I've been wanting hydrogen to work for a long time, and I'd be really happy if they start getting this stuff working.
You know who you have to talk to on this one is Uncle Bob.
Really? Why is it?
He has a pilot's license.
Oh, yeah, sure. Sure.
Okay, so what's so cool about it? I didn't read any of the articles, by the way, because I was busy, but...
Well, you know, hydrogen is a totally clean energy source. The only thing it makes is water vapor when you burn it. And if we could put it in systems like this helicopter, we sort of concentrate the places we create pollution and then deal with it there. And then you could have millions of cars running on hydrogen fuel cells without any smog, for instance. It would decrease the cost of cars because you wouldn't need to distribute all this other stuff everywhere.
So how long do the fuel cells last? You know, some of the practical things, how much do they hold? Like, how long can this helicopter fly between refuelings?
That's the news here. They think that they've got technology. What's the problem with hydrogen is because it's only one electron and one proton, it gets out. Wherever you put it, it tends to get out. Yeah, it's just not a lot there. It's a lot of quantum activity, not a lot of joint up activity. So people have been trying to do hydrogen fuel cells and hydrogen storage systems for a long, long time, and knock on wood, I'm hoping that they're getting close to it. Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this next one, oh my God, guys. Okay, Are any, either of you familiar with cascading style sheets? And either the cam froze or nobody's familiar with. That was a great time for the cam to freeze. So
that's got to be it.
I apologize, guys. I noticed that my CPU was pinging out 100% before I started the meeting today, and I thought, well, it'll work itself out, and no, it has not. It is. But do you guys know CSS? Have you used cascading style sheets in the past?
Unfortunately.
Yeah. So the idea is that...
I have no idea what this means. And so I'll give you the CSS in my day, but...
Easy pitch is, okay, HTML, you have stuff on a web page, right? And that stuff is inside a tag. And the tag has a name. It can have other things like an attribute or an ID or whatever. But you have text inside these tags. Well, cascading style sheets, the whole idea is that we separate the presentation from the data so that, well, you know, on this page or all pages, we want the headline to look the same. So we make a rule, all H1s look the same across the site, and it cuts down on the work.
Yep. And by the way, the page behind you looks like they are absolutely not using one.
No, no, I stripped it out. This is the W3 committee. I stripped it down to minimums. So that was fun, and that was a really good idea because you separation of concerns. But the cascading part said you can add multiple style sheets, and then you have a rules in each one of these style sheets, and they may or may not conflict with one another. So you're some poor little web programmer. And you're looking at like a little piece of text off a button somewhere, you know, the first thing you have to ask yourself is how many different style sheet rules are affecting that little button. And it may be one, it may be 50, you don't know.
I love how the one thing I know about style sheets is that if you really want it to do something, you have to put the word important next to it.
So style sheets have become, they're almost becoming a programming language. They're getting more and more stuff stuck into them. And somebody, when we started doing these web, these build, we're doing, of course, now we have compilation system for web. You know, Webpack does that. They said, hey, I know what would be even more fun. Let's take the rules that we're going to apply to the style sheet and make little sub-rules inside those rules. So now you're looking at that little button with a little piece of text on it, and you may have 50 different style sheets that hit the button, and each of those little rules may have bunches of little sub-rules on them. It's like, holy shit. Good luck, guys.
The concept with style sheets has not only been applied to HTML.
To XPath?
No, it's also been applied to things like when you're writing books. So basically you write your book and there's a markdown type language. And then there's a style sheet that gets applied to it. The main idea being, I can write a book, I can hand it to a publisher. The publisher then applies their standard style sheet to it.
Is there a standard language now for that? Or is it still everybody's proprietary?
There are a couple standard ones, which is always the problem.
Yeah. So for Pragmatic, when I wrote test-driven development for Embedded C, they had their own XML-like thing.
Cool. Today, many are using Markdown.
Yes.
Yeah, I like that much better.
But even with Markdown, you start getting into like weird things, especially with formatting. And like, where do I want this image to go associated to the text?
So for those of you who...
So you have to reinvent HTML again.
Well, yeah, if you want to have lots of fun, I did this when I wrote my first ebook. Look into EPUB format. EPUB format basically is HTML files and images. And then you have a manifest at the top that lists them all, and then you zip the whole thing up and call it EPUB, and you got Bob's your own.
Well, no. If you write in Markdown, which you can write only in Vim, you can actually export to EPUB.
Yeah, you can export several places. You can, you know, what I did in one of my blog engines is actually you can translate on the fly between Markdown and HTML, which is really cool. So style sheets are a hunk of burning fun. They made a lot of sense when they got started. They become their own little nightmare of things like everything else in our business. And now they're the standards committee is adding even more stuff. Yay, guys.
They are approaching their end of life.
That's going to be great.
Well, you know, not only did they add these rules in, but then they said, okay, well, how about if the mouse hovers? We'll have, like, a rule for that, and we'll have, like, a rule. And then once you start adding all these rules, and you're actually adding behavior to the page, you're not really just putting in display stuff.
Is there an if statement in CSS now?
There probably will be.
That's all we need is an if statement in CSS, and then the real fun can happen.
That's why me and Feathers got talking the other day. He talked about a language that didn't have Booleans in it. Like, what? And, of course, it's the old hunk of fun of three-value Booleans, which is yes, no, or beats me.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe, yeah. Hey, it could be. Maybe not. It's like a magic 8-ball. Like, hey, not today.
You know, that type is used in quite a few functional languages as a foundational type.
Oh, yeah, we have optional type.
What, maybe?
Sure. Yeah. Maybe, sure. Yeah. Monad, yep. It is, and I think it's important to know how to handle it, know what they are, know how to handle it. I never let my maybes or optionals go past the interface layer with the outer system because it can make your logic deep inside awful dang hard to figure out. I mean, also, Michael, do you really want, like, be inside somewhere and get a function, a structure, like 20 optional types? It's like, fuck, what is it? It's like, do I have an age? Do I have a number? It's too much to try to figure out.
Tell us the rest of your complaints about JavaScript.
Oh, wow, JavaScript. Yeah. And it's taking over the world, too. That's the great thing about JavaScript. It hadn't even got started yet. So NASA says, surprise, surprise, there's no way Artemis is going to launch at all this year. If you've been following off rockets, we've got SpaceX, Musk, 20 years ago said, hey, we're going to build reusable rockets. Everybody said, no, that's stupid. NASA said, let's take the space shuttle technology we've already built and just use it to launch stuff. Everybody said, oh, that sounds pretty cool. That sounds like a lot of contracts for Northrop Grumman and all these people. And then Blue Origin came along to a bunch of other guys. So flash forward 20 years, SpaceX is doing all kinds of bang-up cool stuff with reusable rockets. The NASA folks have the Space Launch System, which has now been called the Senate Launch System because everybody from the Senate are the people who funded all this stuff. And it's not doing so well. I don't know if they're going to launch at all in a while. And it's not good. Not good. It's sad. It's almost like one of those games when you're a kid. Like one team just so destroys the other team. You're like, just stop. Go home, guys. Get ice cream. Just stop the whole thing. This is bad, guys. Yeah, it's just bad.
Who could imagine that staffing an organization at the top with people who have no idea about what they're actually doing might turn out poorly.
And look at NASA. We've given NASA at least like a dozen different missions, all of which conflict sometimes with one another. We want science. We want manned missions. I want to go to Jupiter. I'd like to go to the moon. I want to go to Mars. I can count like half a dozen missions just in the last 10 years we've given those guys to do.
Yeah, and where is HAL? And where is the trip to Jupiter?
I know nothing about how to be a super cool manager.
What year was it? I thought that was supposed to happen 20 years ago.
Yeah, I know. I don't know anything about how to be a super cool manager, but I know that what Musk seems to be doing that Zuckerberg did before him is saying, here is a clear thing I want to do. In Musk's case, I want to go to Mars cheaply. In Zuckerberg's case, he kept a big counter of all the current Facebook users on the wall. And by giving everybody a clear goal, at least you can kind of center like what your discussions around are doing.
Well, with the going to Mars, what's interesting about it is we've been capable of it. For some time, we've been capable of it.
One of the big problems is, what do you do about the people going there, though? I mean, are we capable of protecting them? From just the radiation?
Going to go lava tubes. You're going to have to go in lava tubes. Probably on the moon, too. Same reason.
You'd have to what?
Go into lava tubes underground.
Oh, yeah. Because in orbit, you've got the magnetic field helping, right?
Yes. There's,
by the time you get to the moon, you don't have that anymore. And
if you want to be an old crank, really truly old cranky guy and piss off nerds, point out that both the moon and Mars are not very nice places to want to go. I mean, Mars is basically a freezing desert full of alkali sand. It's just not much of a vacation spot, really.
You've seen the Schwarzenegger movie, though. They can change that.
You might be surprised how good of a tan you could get on Mars.
You could get it. Oh, yeah, sure. But yeah, having said that, if you built a robotic construction crew somehow or another, I mean, I can actually see building large habitats on the Moon and Mars that would be livable.
I think we are probably still 20 years away from that. But it's likely within our lifetimes.
I'm just so happy we're finally doing something. I remember 79, 81, I was about 5-6 years old, seeing some of the last astronauts on the moon. And those guys, they were talking, hey, we're going to build this space shuttle thing, and then we're going to, you know, go to the moon and Mars. And I was just so excited at the time, and none of that bullshit ever happened. They retired the space shuttle. It was a sad time for a long time.
So I was talking with a friend who's actually somewhat involved with things, and he gave a bit of an explanation about why all of the things to the moon basically stopped, which made a lot of sense.
Okay.
They had gone up there, they had done a bunch of exploring, and they did not really find any valuable resources. Which is what they were expecting to find.
Not just a bunch of sand.
Well, didn't the Google founders invest in a startup a couple years ago to get an asteroid and bring it into Earth orbit that's got, because they know where the asteroids are that have gold and titanium in it. That's what you're really looking for. The next step I would look for would be an orbital fueling station for rockets. If you build one of those, you know we're serious about where we're going.
Is one of the problems with mining it, bringing an asteroid here, that it would then destroy the world economy because there'd be plenty, something that used to be scarce?
There was an African king who was the richest man ever who ever lived. He decided he wanted to go to Mecca, I forget it, 1,000 years ago. And on the way, he took a bunch of gold and just handed it out to everybody he ran into. And it destroyed all these economies that on the way because gold became trivial. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I don't know.
You should probably still go get an asteroid anyway, though.
Well, see if you can get an asteroid put in low Earth orbit. You can refuel space systems. You can build new structures without having to send them in, come out of the gravity well. That's the thing. The reason to look for that is because then we're looking for more, even more commerce happening in space. You've got to have commerce. And if you don't have commerce, nobody's going to go.
You sound like a capitalist, Daniel.
I'm a libertarian. We don't believe in capitalism.
Yeah, you'd much rather have the overlords control all the resources, I know.
Yeah, the invisible hand. I think it's weird how I read up on all this stuff when I was in my late teens, on my own, Adam Smith, all that. And then you run across these same guys who were mentioned in popular culture. And they don't even sound like the same guys you were reading when you're just like, people don't understand these concepts anywhere near what the concepts actually are anymore.
If I remember correctly, and I'm trying to remember the name of the author, but he put it in a very, very nice way. He said that capitalism is not a form of economics. Capitalism is just the natural state of things.
Yeah, that's an excellent
people
point.
People want to work for their reward.
It's an excellent point because
you want to say in it.
we're not instituting capitalism the way you would like download a new Android system. I think people really get mixed up with this. We don't like install economies with different features on them. I know it would be really cool if we could, I guess, for some folks. But what we find is that people trade stuff in a capitalistic manner all the time, whether we want them to or not. And so capitalism really is in response to the fact that this is just, we're traders. That's what humans are. We trade stuff.
Yeah.
Do you know where this is most visible?
Huh. China.
No, in Eastern Europe.
Okay, why is that?
Okay, so go back to 1992 and bring a pair of Jordans.
Oh, yeah, sure.
With you to Eastern Europe. I am rather certain there'd be many willing to negotiate with you on price for this.
There's a good book called The Culture Cult that was all about, I guess, in the 80s, the field of anthropology just sort of got overrun with relativism. And I think it's fine if you're studying something not to bring as bias into whatever you're studying. I think that I'm all for that. But what really happened was nobody brought any sort of critical thinking at all. And the guy who wrote the book, who was an anthropologist when it first came out, was like, you know, guys, when you go to these islands that have never been visited and you meet somebody with has this gleam in their eye, it's not out of love or goodness. They want to trade with you. They're there for the goods, the stuff.
Since like 2007, I've probably gone to China 15 times. And one of the things that's so evident there, even though it's, you know, a communist country, is that people trade stuff. We needed to print out materials for a training class. So we went down to the street where people had bought a copy machine and had a closet. And you could walk up to the closet and negotiate a price for reproducing, you know, a PDF file. And then you'd leave with one. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of them all competing with each other. And if I happened to be around, the price was about 10 times what it was if the Chinese guys wanted it.
Right? Sure.
And so, you know, they thought the market could bear that.
Yeah, capitalism gets a really bad rap because there are folks who are psychopaths, basically, who become CEOs and do bad things like build cars that blow up. And the whole thing gets blamed on, well, you're just focusing on money instead of values. But they're missing out on the other 99% of folks like Sam Walton who say, hey, let's do something really cool so we can make people's lives better. And they carry their values with them because they realize that being a good person actually is pretty good business.
Yeah.
Well, but there's the other side of this, which is when we start putting bureaucrats in charge of these decisions, bureaucrats are just as psychotic as business owners. The difference is I'm forced to interact with a bureaucrat.
That's right. You've got the legal position.
The thing is about China, most people don't realize that Chinese companies and American companies dealing with Chinese companies, you're required to put political actors in positions of management as part of that company. And so those folks really are beholden to the national politics, their political party. Your company's just like a little peon.
Oh, you know, at the time, I did go to Huawei, and I didn't really know. You know, it was through a third party that said, here, we need you over here. So I went there. And, man, talk about a place that is really careful about not letting you steal any of their stuff. Yeah. My computer had so much, like, tape over all the ports and everything that I think if one of the computers in my shelf back here probably still has Huawei tape on over the USB ports.
To keep people from putting things in the USB port?
Because they don't want me to steal any of their stuff, you know.
This is actually fairly common when you go into finance organizations as well.
Yeah.
A lot of them will not even allow you to bring in your own laptop.
Yeah. But so, you know, this was definitely other times I've been to China was with European or American companies that had a place in China. And with Huawei, it was a Chinese company run by a general, basically, with the CCP that ran the place. And very different culture, you know, shoulder-to-shoulder programmers, you know, pressure on everybody. And there was no interest in the management changing because they had finally paid their dues and gotten out of the trenches. It's like, okay, you know, we could have people have self-organizing teams. It's like, well, then what would I do?
Yeah, the Chinese are not, like this. Chinese are not.
You help them self-organize.
They're not implementing capitalism. They're doing more mercantilism, where the government and the businesses are the same thing. A friend of mine does security consulting, and he was recommending how to go to China with your notebook because they'll steal your crap. You know, while it's going through customs, they'll steal your crap. And his recommendation was to use glitter. You sprinkle glitter on your stuff. And then anybody who breaks it open busts the glitter up so you can see the glitter doesn't match up anymore with itself and you can see your stuff has been hacked.
Huh. Yeah.
Cool stuff.
There are much easier ways.
I wouldn't take anything to China that I really wanted at all. I just would not do that.
Try running hardware encrypted drives. That's a really good start.
I have a Linux notebook I have right now with a hardware encrypted drive. that
it's I'm going to try just not going to China.
It's an external. It's an external drive. I have no internal drive in that notebook at all. You take the notebook with you. The customs opens it. You say, "Hey, it's broken." It's broken. You can't fix it. Put the USB drive in. It's got an encrypted drive now, and you can boot up Linux and run like you want to. Matter of fact, you can mail yourself the USB drive, and just pick it up wherever the hotel or whatever. And they can't get into that either. I hate to say, I was thinking this morning that it may be time for my wife to get a hardware key, UBF hardware key, because it's just security's getting so bad now. Do you use hardware keys?
Not today. I've looked at doing it, but I haven't had a good reason to.
I do on the front door, the back door, and the garage door.
So here's my Nano Ledger cryptocurrency wallet. Very cool. You plug it in. It's unhackable. Then here is a YubiKey, one of many keys I have. USB. It's got a fingerprint reader. And so you just put it in. And then if you don't have this and you don't have my finger, you're not getting my stuff.
I used to use a small USB device, which was basically signed. And my laptop would not turn on without it.
Yes. Yeah. I hate to even talk this way, because this was full tinfoil hat territory 10 years ago. And now it's just like normal talk.
Well, the cool thing about that little device was, if you attempted to turn on my laptop without it plugged in, my laptop would automatically erase.
Ooh, cool.
I'm glad you have really good backups.
Well, I was just going to say that this is obviously the best thing to have when you're traveling a lot. And then you're out in London at 1 o'clock in the morning coming back from the pub. You open up your laptop and have just forgotten to plug it in. And it wipes your entire drive.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's why I have more than one hardware key. Because you only got the one key. Yeah, you're out at the pub. And what goes down the gutter and you lost your life. So I got to tell you one story before we end. My wife manages foster kids, foster families. And she was telling me this morning that she has to get Social Security cards for them. And the Social Security office wants her to mail her identification in to get her kids' Social Security cards. So they want her passport or driver's license. Yeah. And she's like, I am not mailing in the only identity I have here for you. She called them up, I think day before yesterday. She said, look, I got this kid. And I've got all these other kids. I need to get it fixed. And the guy was like, you know, we'll make an exception for you. There's an app to download. And so to go to the Social Security office, you download an app. You go to the place where the office is. You wait for the app to tell you that it's okay to go in. You have your mask. And they'll come get you. If you bring somebody else, they can't come in. If somebody besides you comes, they can't come in. You have to answer all these questions about have you been around people with COVID or whatever. I said, like, you know, I can email $1 billion to somebody in 2 seconds, and it's going to take you, like, 6 hours to go to a Social Security card for somebody. It's just... Wow.
Bureaucrats in charge.
Well, the joke I made was, like, you know, thank goodness those guys have implemented that, because they used to be so whiz-bang, you know, fast there. You couldn't keep track of them with your eye. They were just moving around so fast. I'm glad they finally slowed down a little bit.
They hand them out at the border, though, like this?
You create an inefficient system. The only thing you're doing is creating incentives for people to go around the system.
I have a client, and they sent me this, you know, they like red tape, you know, so we get a deal going, and it's like, oh, here, fill out these forms. And one of them was requiring a letter from my bank to say, you know, James does have control of these accounts, and these are his accounts. He had to be signed by a banker, had to have their letterhead. Chase Bank won't do it, okay? Because we don't do custom stuff like this. We got to find something we have. Client won't accept what they have. Back and forth. I wasted so much time on this. And then finally they said, oh, well, then I guess we'll just have to pay you with a check.
This was an option all along.
What? Yeah, it was an option all along, and I wasted like 3 days.
Well, yeah, with the Social Security thing, I know they're trying to prevent identity fraud, and it may make sense to make it difficult for Joe Blow, but if you've got 20 kids you need Social Security cards for, you're in a different category of service. You really need some kind of faster way of doing this stuff.
You keep making a small mistake here. You keep thinking that they care.
Yes, there I go again, using reason and logic. Yeah. All right, guys, go ahead. Anything you want to say? You guys been watching any good TV shows or consuming any good stuff you want to share?
I just got an exciting pop-up on my browser.
What was
it? And I clicked it because it was Xfinity offering 2 gigabit internet service, which I upload some big videos, and the normal internet is limited because of the technology on the upload speed can't be more than 30 megabits a second because of whatever they're doing there. So it's not symmetrical. So 2 gigabit, guess how much they want to charge for it?
I have no idea.
$300 a month.
Wow.
So everybody, please don't buy it. Okay, no matter how much you want it, wait for them to bring the cost down. I had the same thing in Florida with CenturyTel for $79 a month.
Yeah, you're making me really sad, James. Really sad. I'm paying $150 a month for like a 20th of that.
Yeah, okay, well.
I live
really
in this
state. What depends, though, is how far are you from their current infrastructure?
Yeah, so in Florida, I'm in a new neighborhood, and half the neighborhood had fiber right to the house.
Oh.
And so, you call CenturyTel and they come over, they send you a modem and they send a guy over, and $79, and you've got gigabit. You could buy two if you wanted to.
I want to try this Elon Musk, what is it, X-Link or whatever it is with the satellites. Yeah. It looks pretty cool.
But then Comcast.
I'm guessing it's high latency, though.
They say that it's much better than the HughesNet stuff, that it's, 10, 20 milliseconds. So it's not as good as fiber, but it's not as bad as what you would expect. Good enough to play games on. Good enough to video conference.
It was great shoving up, big video files and stuff instead of having to plan it and then expect I'm not doing anything else for a while.
When I had satellite, I had to get up at 2 a.m. in the morning to do uploads Go ahead.
Yeah, but you live in the middle of nowhere. What do you expect?
Now, I'm going to tell you a little known fact.
You should be using Morse code there.
Back in my day, kid, we just mail USB drives around.
You guys know I used to live out in Lithuania. Lithuania has some of the best broadband in all of the world.
I bet.
Oh, wow.
I know that sounds like completely ridiculous.
No, I've heard parts of Africa, like cell phone coverage is like 98% because they don't have infrastructure, but you can buy a cell phone.
No. Going back many years ago, like what you guys are talking about is like your upgrades. It's like we already had that.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think, when you're starting off with a system, so Lithuania being FSU, right, former Soviet Union, they didn't have anything. And so now they're investing, and they were there at the beginning of the new technology.
That's why we don't have anything here. We're fighting the established vendors.
They are also a test bed for a lot of the new technologies. Especially around Vilnius and Kaunas, the two major markets that you have. There's a lot of new technologies get brought in there, essentially to try them.
Yeah.
So about 5 years ago...
It's kind of like we've got a city of like 800,000 people, and it's a capital. Why don't we move this in and see what happens?
About 5 years ago, my congressman had one of these open house come to talk to me things, and it was about broadband in our area. So I'm like, hey, I know this. I can go in. And I was telling the guys, look, we need to move with the rest of the world here. We should go gigabit. And they looked at me and said, why would we ever want to do that? And it's it's kind of hard. If you don't have it, it's hard to tell you about it, really.
Yeah.
Who needs 64 gigs of RAM?
Yeah. Who would need 64K?
Yeah. let me do my goodbye things. Hang on, guys. Okie dokie now, you have wasted yet another hour and 15 minutes on Nerd Roundup. You could have been spending that time writing a letter to your mother, doing something for an orphanage. But no, you're here with us on Nerd Roundup, and we're really happy you stopped by. We'll be here next week. I'm Daniel Markham. I will see you on the internet.